Davina McCall.
Davina McCall filmed the making of the Jamiroquai video. So we were hanging out and teaching Davina McCall how to snowboard and hanging out with her. She rules. She is the coolest chick ever. And then last second, Noel Gallagher approved Slide Away. And then I end up doing a snowboard series with Kylie Minogue. We did a feature called Try and Survive where they try to kill me every week. We just won a BAFTA, man. Like, yeah, you know, cheap little show. We beat Dick and Dom in the bungalow. Come on.
Welcome to Scenes, conversations on culture with the people who know it best. We chat with guests across music, art, fashion, film, sport, and technology in a bid to understand the scenes we love that little bit better. I am your host, Kosti Kontaravdis, and today Max and I chat all things action sports with a man whose face and voice has been an iconic part of the last 30 years of this scene. The legendary presenter, filmmaker, and BAFTA-winning producer, Christian Stevenson. For those of you who will know Christian as DJ Barbecue, the best-selling author of 5 barbecue cookbooks with over 160,000 YouTube subscribers and huge collaborations with Jamie Oliver, you'll have to wait a little bit longer for the second segment of this 2-part episode, because for now, this is the Action Sports Scene, brought to you by Truant London.
Listeners of the world, silence in the studio. Today marks a milestone in Scene's history because today we're honored to share the room with our very first BAFTA winner.
Oh yeah.
It's a children's BAFTA. It's still a BAFTA.
We're thrilled to bring you the unmistakable face and voice of Action Sports. You may know him as the presenter of Rad on Channel 5 or from one of his 5 best-selling barbecue cookbooks, a presenter, filmmaker, actor, producer, chef, and father of 4?
4 now, yeah.
Father of 4, please make some noise wherever you may be for the one and only Christian Stevenson, a.k.a. DJ Barbecue.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, man.
I had a baby at BAFTA. I mean, I made a baby. That night, after we won the BAFTA, I went to the director's room and got hammered with him because we're celebrating, right?
Yeah.
We just won a BAFTA. Channel 5's first. We were sitting at the same table as Peppa Pig, not the Peppa Pig.
The voice of
the producers and stuff. Wow. And I got 3 times security came to the room in the Parkland Hill and said, You need to calm it down, Mr. Stevenson. But we just won a BAFTA, man. Like, cheap little show. We beat Dick and Dom in the bungalow. Come on.
Iconic show.
And then after the 4th visit, they frog marched me to my room.
Nice.
And then I made a baby that night.
So you can't tell me what to do.
Oh, man, a little story of perseverance there, I think.
And then 9 months later, my missus and I had a fight. We're now divorced. And I went outside to kind of, you know, cool off. And then I hear, hey, my water broke. Oh, and I'm like, what? Whoa. So I delivered the baby because we were doing a home birth. I called the midwife. I called the hospital. No one turned up. So I delivered that baby that we made at BAFTA.
Nice.
On our living room floor.
With your very own hands.
Yeah, I just caught him.
Yeah.
He did all the hard work.
I just caught him. Well, shout out to that lady and shout out to that baby as well. That's amazing, man. So Christian, before we begin, there's something I need to get off my chest.
Oh, shoot.
So you've been hanging out with some of the biggest names in action sports.
Mm-hmm.
I got to ask, what's the raddest trick you've ever seen?
Whew, boy, that's a good one. I mean, is it snowboarding? Is it surfing? Is it skateboarding? And it's going to have to be skateboarding. It's going to be 1999, X Games, San Francisco, best trick contest. Tony Hawk landed the 900. Easy.
You have it, folks.
So Wayne Yates, our director, and myself, we were on both sides of the ESPN guy. Now, they have a special chair they've designed for filming Vert. It's a swivel chair that sits on 2 bars, so he can just go like that and just film Vert. So we're next to him with our PD-100s, PD-150s, I think we had as well. Yeah. And I go, Wayne, film any of everything, because whatever we get from ESPN, it'll be what they want to give us. I want to make sure we cover everything, because we got Colin McKay, we got Bob Burnquist, we got Bucky Lassick, some big names. And Colin McKay was just destroying lip tricks, and we got them all. So our feature was heavily on Colin, and of course, until Tony started going for the 9. And when he goes for the nine, he lands really low on the transition because he's got to get those spins in. And he told me it's like being in a car wreck every time he doesn't land it. And he didn't land it nine times. Wow. But he lands it right. If you watch it, it's right at the bottom of the transition.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He pulls it off and, you know, one hand down, but we're going to let him do that.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, that's fine. It's cool. It's cool that after everyone knows and like realizes what he's doing, everyone just stops doing their own shit.
Oh, yeah. It's like, they do.
Everyone's just on Tony Hawk to just.
They, like Andy McDonald and Bucky were like trying to just throw props to him, you know, trying to give as much karma as they could. It was an amazing scene. And I'm sitting with, you know, Steve Caballero, Danny Way, Danny DeVito. Yeah. There was some big names. Yeah, because his son skates. And he was.
Right.
And we were trying to get I was trying to get an interview with Danny DeVito, but I interviewed, you know, Cab was crying, he had a tear in his eye after he landed it, and Bernquist took his board to where Tony landed the nine and put it on the transition and then planked, just kind of straightened his body, and just because he's all spiritual and he was just like soaking up
the energy.
Yeah. And there was energy there. It was like Wayne said, you could have lit up San Francisco for 2 weeks with the amount of energy that Tony created with that crowd.
That's amazing. I mean, that's
the Holy Grail.
Honestly. Yeah, the most iconic moment in skateboarding history of our time, at least. That really set the pave. And I think that moment sparked the new era of skateboarding scene in some respect, at least because of Tony Hawk doing his thing and how that went on to video games and how that went into just like Tony Hawk being the character on The Simpsons doing skateboarding, being the reference point of skateboarding all over the world. It was him. And I think it was really that trick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, skateboarding is a cycle. Every 10 years, it gets big. You know, we had it in 85, 86. It was 87. It was all big, especially in America. And then it kind of died out. And then, you know, vert skating wasn't really doing a whole lot. And then you get to like 95, 96, 97, 98, it gets big again. And, you know, it was the video game that saved his career. He said that.
Wow.
That's right. And then he was able to buy his house because it was one of the biggest royalty checks he's ever had. Because before that, they had the whole Pal Peralta. They had a couple teams. And, you know, in the 80s, you were able to kind of concentrate on pros.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in the 90s, there was just tons. Everybody was getting a pro board. And I think that it got a bit confusing for people, but the video game helped elevate certain people.
Well, speaking of skateboarding, let's take it all the way back.
Okay.
So you were growing up in the 70s and 80s skateboarding in Maryland.
Yep, in Maryland.
At that point, I feel like skateboarding was seen as something that was done by people who were seen in the world as like antisocial, juvenile delinquents. Would you agree?
Oh, gosh, yes. People spat on me when I was snowboarding like in 85.
Right.
You know, you'd be on a mountain and you had to take a test to get on certain levels of the mountain. Like in Pennsylvania and New York, they in most places it was banned in the mid 80s. But, you know, what are you doing? Oh, what are you riding? You know, everybody was just, we were scum.
Right.
But at least the cool thing about skating and snowboarding and these action sports, these sideways sports is, you had a camaraderie. If you saw somebody nowadays, you don't really go and search out that skateboarder and talk to him. But back then, you know, you skate, you snowboard, you know, it was a big deal to have that, you know, affinity with somebody.
Yeah.
It was special.
So how did it feel then to like, so it sounds like you didn't really mind being seen as a criminal or like part of that counterculture.
Oh, man, I embraced it and I wanted to document it. So I went to school for film and TV and, I was always making short little films about skateboarding. In high school, I made a movie called Crime Doesn't Pay, where I dressed up all my skating buddies as school administrators. And then me and Scott Ketchin, who was one of our better skaters at our high school, he stole some cheese and crackers from the school lunch line. And then the next thing is we're being chased by all these like, you know, school administrators.
Yeah.
But it's all my buddies, you know, in suits. And then I ended the whole film with, they had to get like a really hot chick to kind of like get all the, get the dirt on who was his accomplice. And then he died of a heart attack from that meeting.
Sounds like a riveting story.
It was a riveting story.
That's amazing. So,
so good.
That was my first skate film.
So when did you know that filming action sports could be more than just a hobby?
It was weird. Like, okay, I went to university from 1986 till 1990. And the whole time I was you know, I would go to the beach and work all summer skating, surfing, and working my buns off to buy camera gear. And then I would bring the camera gear back to University of Maryland. And then I was just looking for little ditches to skate, to film. If it snowed, we go film some snowboarding. And as soon as I got my degree, I went out to Colorado and I started, snowboarding, you know, as much as I could.
Yeah.
And I got a job on mountain doing customized ski videos for tourists. And then I would always, if it was a slow day, I'd take the camera gear, 3 chip I-8. And I go down to the half pipe and film, you know, all the pros, Steve Alters, Adam Merriman, Todd Richards would be there because Vail had a good pipe. And so I would just film it all. And that's why I was just always thinking, I'm going to make a living making films about action sports, even though I didn't think it would really happen. But I remember my Uncle Rip, who was a surfer from Virginia Beach, he showed me Endless Summer. And then I saw Public Domain, which was Stacy Peralta's, one of his, you know, earlier films. And I saw those two movies and I was like, I can make a living out of this. I can at least try.
If they're doing it, I can do it.
Yeah, lifestyle / work style, you know, everything. Yeah. And that's when I just kind of went for it. And then you fast forward a couple years later and I'm making snowboard films for a living and we got signed to Sony and I was doing music videos on the side to kind of make ends meet.
But with just like snowboarding and then like making music videos or?
So I was making snowboard films because I was watching the likes of, Riders in the Storm, The Hard, the Hungry, and the Homeless, which is a MacDog movie. What was it? Roadkill, which is a David Sione film. Those were like my movies. And of course, all the earlier stuff with all the Pal Peralta stuff. And I was like, I want to make movies. So we started making these films. And then to supplement it, I was directing music videos for Jamiroquai, Reef, and all these bands. And this company who saw me running around, I had a little agent there at their building and they were making Gillette World Sport. They were making, they invented Hawkeye camera for like cricket. So they were a big sports company. They go, hey, do you want to shoot a pilot called Rad for this new network coming up called Channel 5? And I'm like, yeah, sure. But if we get the show, I can't do it because I got to go back to the States and make another snowboard film. Because I've been shooting here in Europe and I got to go back and do some more filming in the States. And I go, what do you want to call it? They go, we're going to call it Rad. I go, that's a good name. Rad's a good name.
Yeah.
I go, why do you guys want to call it Rad? They go, because that's all you say.
Yeah.
And so we shot this pilot with Danny Wainwright. It was about the illegalities of skateboarding in London.
Yeah.
We showed that wherever you go, you're going to get kicked out. Like we were on Liverpool Street and we were just kind of skating with Danny there. And I did all the links to camera. I bombed Liverpool Street with a VX1000. So I'm talking to Cameron and everything's just shooting by me. And I'm just like weaving through crowds, you know, doing all my links. And no one had ever seen something like that. And the network, I think Channel 5 gave us 23 shows.
Nice.
And that was the beginning of Rad. 17 seasons, 250 episodes, 4 BAFTA nominations, 1 win, and 3 RTS nominations. So we did all right for a little skateboarding show.
That's amazing. So when you were filming that really epic shot in Liverpool Street, how did you get the approval of the council?
No. It's about the illegalities of skateboarding.
Exactly. And I think that's what's so exciting about the scene and in skateboarding and in all action sports, you basically have to do it yourself. And I think that's what's really inspiring about you as well, because you weren't just filming, you were getting in front of the camera, you were voicing over, you were part of the process in every way.
Mm.
And I think that's really like, it reminds me now of seeing all these content creators trying to do it all. And it's more exciting, in my opinion, to start there. But then when it moves into like TV and you're sort of presenting the show called Rad and you're doing it for like 10 years, like when did you think that was going to end?
We just didn't want it to end because it was like the best job in the world.
Right.
You know, because at first we were a magazine type show. So we had skateboard trick of the week. We go film a jam. We do profiles, but it was very bitty. You know, it was just all these kind of little segments. One week we did a feature called Try and Survive where they try to kill me every week. So one week I'm going wing walking on the Utterly Butterly plane. Then I'm learning how to race hovercrafts or race Vespas at Mallory Park, or the most dangerous thing I've ever done in my life. And I've hiked so many mountains. I've climbed volcanoes. You know, I've done some pretty crazy ascents. Robin Reliant Racing.
Those three-wheelers.
The three-wheeler.
Yeah.
Was the single most scariest thing I've ever done. And because like, you know, we've got cameras on my car and stuff. A lot of the stuff was pre-GoPro. So it was like lipstick cameras with a big body. So it, you know, it was hard to film all this kind of stuff. And I'm in this car and everything's kind of taped up and you know, it's fiberglass, but you've got a roll cage.
Yeah.
And so here I am with like 13 cars and, you know, you only got two gears. So I'm thinking this ain't going to be bad, but it's muddy. You know, you're always sliding. And I watched like, you know, so many cars flip in like the first lap. And
I'm
like, oh my God. So I get three laps in and then the other guys are like, well, we want to get on camera. So they started coming after me. So one car comes flying from like my side, tries to hit me, but he hit me wrong. So he starts flipping. So I'm like, you know, going and I look and there's this car right next to me just rolling. And I'm like, oh my God. And then I'm like, okay. And then I look in front of me and another car hits some other dude. And then he starts rolling right in front of me, but you can't jerk too hard or you'll roll.
Yeah.
So I'm like, and then I watch this guy fly into a pylon, you know? And I'm like, and my heart's racing. I'm like, that is the single most exciting, you know, 20 seconds of my life.
Yeah.
I got a couple laps in and then I blew the engine. And then some guy came from behind, jacked me up. And then I had to go for physio for quite some time. That's the thing about that show. You know, you're doing all these things, you're filming it, but you're also getting hurt.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of injuries to do it. My knees are shot, you know, I got holes in lots of places, but it was worth it. Cause it was a job, but I didn't feel like I was going to work. I just felt like I was creating really cool stuff to get people stoked.
And stuff that you would watch and your friends would watch, which I think is what a lot of young content creators are now realizing. They don't have to commercialize themselves and try to be this niche presenter. They can document the thing that they fall in love with. What I would say is, what advice do you give to those young and amateur filmmakers who are out there trying to do their thing?
Man, yeah, do what you love, have fun. I mean, it's such a social media is so crazy now and it's moving so quick.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still trying to keep up with it. That's why I hired my oldest son, who's 23, to help me run it all, because he understands that world. My world's old school. So I don't know. I mean, just, you know, film what makes you happy. You never really know what's going to hit.
I mean,
my most watched video is me and two buddies having poached eggs in Isle of Wight. And my friend cut a poached egg next to some baked beans. And it was the yolk going into the baked beans that divided the world.
The money shot.
2.5 million views.
Yeah. You never know. You never know what's going to blow up.
You don't know.
Yeah. But you must have been saying something while it's happening.
No, I'm like, hey, come on. Because I know what hits.
Mm.
Opening up a poached egg.
Oh, that's it. It's the money shot.
It's a money shot. That's one of those shots you want to get. But it's because it went into baked beans. that every comment was a puke emoji.
Nice.
Hey, press, right?
Yeah, man.
Take the views, man. Take the views. It's the money.
Why is that not any of my other footage? You know, I mean, the 900 got a lot of views.
Oh, of course.
And then we sold the rights, our footage to... All This Mayhem, when they did that documentary about the Pappas brothers.
Yeah.
And, you know, because they tried to interview Tony Ford, and Tony's like, you guys are going to make me look bad no matter what, you know, because it was a Vice movie.
Yeah.
You know, and they have their agenda. So Tony refused to do it, which was smart, I think.
Yeah. Well, luckily you had the footage, right?
We had the footage. So they got it in there.
Nice. So speaking of your footage, your snowboarding films, Odd Man Out and Day Tripper, are considered two of the most iconic snowboarding videos of all time. Even still today, I think Odd Man Out is possibly the most pirated video of all time as well. I read that fact.
One of the most pirated, the top selling snowboard film in the UK and New Zealand, Australia, and I think maybe one of the top, well, Apocalypse was like the biggest selling, I think, French film, and that was like... that was like when they were like, we just roll on.
Yeah,
the A snowboard team was being chased by one of those mono skiers and stuff, and they had football helmets on. That was a bit more pre anything, but I think that's the biggest one. But yeah, we had one of the biggest selling films of all time, and that we did that with Sony.
That's cool.
And we used the footage because I was doing a Jamiroquai video for the band. And they said, how much stock do you need? So I'm shooting everything on 16.
Mm.
And I go, oh, I need I need 40 rolls of stock. 40 rolls? No, I'm sorry, 60. And they go, that's a lot of stock. Well, they don't land every trick, you know. It's a lot of. And so we used all that stock to film for the next 3 months. And then we ended up getting a movie deal with Sony. I said to him, listen, I'd love to release the soundtrack to Odd Man Out, you know, as a CD and a mini disc, because mini disc just dropped then. So we released it as a
mini disc. What an innovation mini disc was.
And they go, yeah, cool. So they go, well, how about this? We'll do the movie and the CD cassette. And then we went to A&M Records and Polygram for Day Tripper. So that went internationally as well. So that was fun. Yeah, actually releasing a nice CD. We had Radiohead on there, you know.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Beyond the death-defying stunts, really what makes them so iconic was the soundtrack. And I've got a list of just some of the names that had featured on there. So you've got Radiohead, Oasis, Reef, Swerve Driver,
yes.
Stone Roses, Placebo, Stanford Prison Experiment, DJ Shadow.
Yeah.
How the heck
Shadow didn't want to do it.
Really?
Because I had Moloko on there and I went to see James Lavelle because he was with the record label Mowax in A&M Records. He's like, oh, Josh doesn't like Moloko. I'm like, well, he's not going to like everything on here. Come on, give me some DJ Shadow. Because Introducing was a big album then. Huge. And Oasis was last second. I actually had Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple for that section. I had it cleared in every territory in the world because you got to clear these things.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. And I couldn't clear it in the UK. And then last second, Noel Gallagher approved Slide Away because that was a deep album cut. But it was a fan favorite. A lot of the snowboarders I was filming, the British guys, they were like, dude, Slide Away, man. That's the tune. And I think it was a better call because we used Slide Away because it really kind of, here's not a single.
Yeah.
But, you know, they had so many songs that were not singles that were so good because
the whole album was amazing.
Oasis should have only done two albums.
Huge fan of Oasis.
Should've stopped.
But the question is how? How did all of those artists who were in the biggest bands of the world at that time just say, use it? Was it money?
There was no money transferred. I got all of those soundtracks for free. None. So I went and saw.
Tell us your secret.
I went and saw every single. It's funny. I was thinking about this on the way here. I went and saw 3 to 4 bands a night.
Yeah.
Every single night, like in 94, 95, 96. I lived in Camden. So I had Dublin Castle on my corner and I could, you know, catch Cool the Shaker. I go to Brixton Academy and I knew all the A&R scouts and they would just go, you know, who's looking hot? I'd try to find that up and coming band, you know, before they blow up. You know, and then you've got people like Stone Roses and stuff. But of course, I can only get music written by Ian Brown. I couldn't get music from John Squire. I wanted Begging You on that. But he wouldn't let me have it. So I had to get Love Spreads. There's all these rules and stuff
because
you got to clear publishing, you got to clear masters, but I would just go meet the band. I'd go hang out with the band. My favorite story was we were trying to get No Doubt for an all female film we were doing. We made it the first female film and I'm playing pinball at the World's End in Camden. And I knew they were doing a sound check that afternoon. So there's a pinball machine where the door is to get downstairs. So I'm just playing pinball, you know, waiting for No Doubt to come in. And then, you know, they all come in. I'm watching them all. And then I wait till the last member goes downstairs. I stick my foot in the door, finish my ball, go downstairs, go to the horn player first or the drummer and work your way up. Get them all into the idea. Hey, I'm making this snowboard film. And then go to Stefani and then the chief songwriter and tell them, get them on board. Everybody's all into it. And then you get a phone call from some lawyer in his car outside of LA saying, you're a dick. I go, what do you mean? They go, these bands just want to work with you. I go, well, we're doing cool stuff. You know, we're going to big up the name. He's like, yeah, but you know, we need money. I go, I don't have money. I got exposure. But luckily with the CD soundtracks, they didn't get publishing money. So I was able to give them some money that way. But on the film, I didn't pay for any soundtracks. And then the first film we did was called Blindside. And Mr. Brett, who owned Epitaph Records, just gave me his library. So we had early Offspring. You know, they just released Smash. So we had, that's when they really blew up. But I mean, we even used Ignition off the first album, Dirty Magic off Ignition. Anyway, that Bad Religion, Pennywise, Mill and Cowan, all those bands. He goes, use whatever you want. Don't worry about getting anything signed. It's yours. I'm like, yes.
You won the lottery that day.
Yeah. Dude, I got Farside on my very first film, but then to get that band, I had to put this other, they had like a metal label on Delicious Vinyl that was sucked. And I had to use like 30 seconds of that band, but I got Farside.
Yeah, worth still it.
Yeah, well, worth that other it. Song sucked.
Yeah, but it's Farside, bro. Come on. that really just reminds me, and it's an ode to doing things like physically instead of just like sending someone a message. You know, the story of you playing Pinball Machine, and you know, you just have to go down and just meet people sometimes. Yeah. Instead of just sending them constant messages on email.
Sliding into their DMs.
Meeting people.
It's meeting people. It's like doing something in the physical. It's like having the CD and the mini disc as well. Like having a finished product that you can tangibly hold.
Yeah.
You know, like that, having all of those elements in the physical world is, it's just such an art that I think is like kind of been lost a little bit.
Oh, totally.
You know, people think it's a lot quicker just to shoot someone an email, but realistically.
Well, we released this Day Tripper, we did a single called Magic Bus. I couldn't afford the Who's version, and the Who are really anti-covers. But luckily for us, so I had Swerve Driver cover it because they were friends, and I was going to gigs and hanging out with them. Mm-hmm. And they go, yeah. I go, can you guys cover Magic Bus for me? Because I can't afford the Who. And then we had to get the Who's approval. But luckily for us, Alan Moulder, who was their engineer who produced Swerve Driver, he was going out with Tony Halliday, who had the same manager as Pete Townsend. So we were able to get a song to him, and Townsend's like, best Who cover I've ever heard, signed it away for us. And we released it on CD, yes, on a 7-inch. Nice. So it's just getting to know those right people, you know?
That's really, it's a story really, it's all about the hustle, right? And getting into people's, getting in the room. If you get yourself in the room and you believe in yourself, you will get it done. Especially with that Gwen Stefani story, you didn't know you were just going to go in there and tell her, can you be on my snowboarding documentary film? You just said like, I've got this amazing project coming up, all female snowboarders, and I want to get your voice in it.
Yeah.
And to her, I imagine that's just the perfect project that she would want to align herself with. And you give off a really nice vibe. It's like, I really trust this guy. He keeps saying I'm rad and I just want to work with him.
But they don't always want to work with you. Like because we had Bush on there.
Right.
And that was Gwen's, you know, ex-husband, Gavin Rosdale.
Right.
And Bush were like the next Nirvana, you know, not as cool, but still they getting tons of plays. And their debut album went nuts. And I remember I knew the manager of the band. I knew Nigel, the guitar player. And I used to kind of roll with a bunch of them, but not the lead singer. And I remember walking up to him at King's Cross Water Rats. And I go, hey, you know, we're hopefully going to be working with you on this soundtrack. And Gavin just goes, Dave, get this guy away from me. You know, he just did not want to deal with me. Flash forward 2009, and Gavin's on his solo album tour. And I'm interviewing him. And I told
remember
him
that me
story. He's like, oh, I sounded like a dick. I'm like, no.
not at all.
But he was cool, you know. He was good looking, and he, you know, you had one of the biggest albums of the year. He didn't want to deal with me, but you know, we still got him.
Just took time.
Luckily I knew the guitar player, Nigel.
Luckily so we really want to be splitting this podcast up about action sports and about your passion for cooking and DJing, but we have a couple more like snowboarding questions we had to ask you, because although we haven't seen all of your films, what we have seen is your music video for Jamiroquai, and in that there is the biggest bail, and I just want a little behind the scenes first take of what happened in that moment. I've got the clip. Want to see the clip?
I think it's going to be Axel Paporte just eating shit.
Yeah. That was because there's a sequence. It starts, there's almost a story being told. At first, they're nailing it. And then all of a sudden, in like the second chorus, they're slamming nearly every single thing.
Well, you know, we want to keep snowboarding real. You know, we planned.
So here's the clip. Boom!
Yeah, that's Axel. That's Axel Paporte, who won twice in Alaska, the Alaskan Extremes, Belgian snowboarder,
right?
And yeah, that's that. He went to the back seat, didn't he?
Yeah,
and almost did a reverse loop de loop. So we got done filming, and we had like this pretty big cornice at the end of the film on the last day of shooting, and JK's like, I had another outfit. I had the same outfit to put on other pros. And Jay's like, no, I'm doing all my own stunts. I'm like, all right. And he went off this cornice and ate shit. And he goes, Kevin, and I'm with his manager, you know, I'm filming, he's watching me, and he's like, cancel Berlin. And Kevin looks at me and I'm like, I'm sorry, dude. I offered to get him a pro, you know, a stunt double, but he wants to do his own things. So he was a bit pissed off because they had to cancel a gig because they were like, they gave me like 3 days in between Berlin and Grenoble. And I'm walking in the car park with Jim Wedlake, my partner in filming, and another guy called Jack Bibbo. And we're walking with JK, and JK goes, Christian, what do you think Light Years is about? And I go, you know, he's quite mystical and he's into the earth. I go, I think it's about not following a 9-to-5 job, doing your own thing, and, you know, kind of forging your own path. And he goes, nope, it's about cocaine.
Close.
Nice try, Christian. So we're going to hit the powder and we're going to go hard.
Yeah, hit that fresh powder.
I didn't even write that video like that, you know?
That's hilarious, man.
That's awesome, man.
It's about cocaine.
How's Jamiroquai as a person?
He's cool. I mean, it took a while to get to meet him because they flew me to Barcelona to meet him and the band, and I just hung out with the band. And after the gig, he just kind of said a couple quick things to me, but he just wanted to party and hook up with a hot chick. So the next day, I'm waiting with all this press to have a meeting with him, and he spent most of the morning and late morning and early afternoon in the hotel with a girl. And
yeah.
Never got to talk with them. So I had to cancel the first week of shooting. Ended up going snowboarding with a bunch of the English guys and the guitarist from Ned's Atomic Dustbin.
Wow.
Yeah, Rat. So, because we had everything booked to film with the band out in Austria and in St. Anton. So at least I got some footage done. And then we were able to get three days with the band. So I spent one day teaching the band how to snowboard. JK already knew what he was doing because he skated. And then we had a day. We stuck a Walkman under JK's hat and he lip-synced the song whilst riding down the mountain.
That's cool. And actually, in our thorough research, there was something else we found where not only you recalling this story, but there was an extra very famous UK presenter in the mix, which was Davina McCall.
Davina McCall filmed the making of the Jamiroquai video. So we were hanging out and teaching Davina McCall how to snowboard and hanging out with her. She rules. She is the coolest chick ever. We had a blast with her. And that led us to kind of working with Sony more, with MTV. And then I ended up doing a snowboard series with Kylie Minogue.
Yeah.
All from that meeting with Davina McCall.
MTV Snowball?
Yeah. And it was myself and Kylie Minogue doing 8 half-hour shows. And she rips. We got done with all of our links on these couple days, and then it snowed heavy while we were filming. So the next day we had about a foot and a half of fresh powder. So she's like, can I come riding with you? And I'm thinking, there's no friends on a powder day, but okay, Kylie, you can come. I'm like, I'm be going slow all day. Boy, did I get it wrong. She's so little and she just kind of just skims on top of the, like, I'm blasting through, you
just
know,
doesn't make
six,
a dent.
6'1". Yeah. She had to make a dent. And
lying.
And she's just flying. I tell you, by the end of the day, there must have been about a dozen people riding with us. Like, can we come ride with you? Because I didn't know who she was. I knew she, you know, was a singer, but I'm from America. I didn't know how big she was. So, you know, because before I was supposed to be doing the show with Mike Patton from Faith No More. Then it was going to be Coolio. And then last second, they swapped her in Kylie Minogue.
What was it like when you heard the name Kylie Minogue?
I just didn't know. I you know, I didn't know who she was, or this is before her spinning around. It was when she did her indie phase. So she was working with Nick Cave and Manic Street Preachers. So I just didn't really know who I was. I just knew I was hanging out with a really cool person who rips on a snowboard and a skateboard.
I wonder where she learned. She's from Australia,
Australia's got a lot of skiable terrain. I did a season down there.
Had no idea.
And she even lied to a heli tour operator and told him that she was a expert to go heli skiing on some pretty gnarly stuff, or snowboarding.
Wow.
Yeah, she rips. I couldn't
That's
believe
amazing.
It.
And Davina?
Davina's just good times.
Yeah.
She's just a good person, easy to hang out with. Every now and then I'll get a random photo sent to me of us hanging out, you know, from those days. Yeah, she rules. I got time for all those people. You know, they say never meet your heroes, and those are two wonderful. I mean, they weren't really heroes of mine, but I'm sure they are to some people, but they're two wonderful people. You know,
so you spent 10 years working on Rad, which is essentially like 10 years on the road, like you're saying, doing stunts, going to all of these corners of the world, traveling all the time. How did you find spending a decade on the road?
I like traveling. I mean, I think you'll become super interesting by meeting more people. Like the more people you can meet, the more interesting you become for the next person you meet, kind of vibe. And it gives you better perspective on life, on cultures, and food. You know, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I loved traveling. It was hard having kids, trying to be, you know, a full-time dad, but I would go away for like, you know, 3 weeks to a month, and then I'd be super dad, you know, for the next couple of months.
With all these cool stories as well.
Yeah. And then, you know, on the weekend, I'd have to go pick up Ross McGowan and Chris Vile and take them to a skate contest, because I was also the Vans skateboard team manager and snowboard team manager. So I was doing, you know, signing talent, taking them to events, you know, because I believed in, Rad was a magazine type show. And then I wanted to make it a bit more cohesive. So we came up with this kind of touring thing where we would, you know, you had Big Brother, you had all these kind of reality shows. I'm like, well, why don't we do reality, but in action sports? So there's something a bit more fun to watch. So we filmed behind the scenes. So what we did is we did a UK tour with all these Grom skaters. And then we pieced it into all the kind of Search for the Holy Rail. That was one of our sketches.
Nice name.
Great.
You know, Try and Survive and all these sketches. And then it was so popular, we're like, well, why don't we just go full board touring? And then we end up doing a couple more UK tours. And then I'm like, I'm going to go to America. So I got some tourist departments involved. We did Rad the Groms tour America, Colorado, Idaho, Utah, Oregon, big old Winnebago, filled it with all these Groms. And that's the one that won the BAFTA. Then we got to do the Baltics. We got to do Australia. I did a snowboarding one. So we did, you know, nine and a half hour show series. Just about touring and everything around, not just the sport. Like I met up with a guy who's a kayaker, Brad, who was number like, top three in the world. And I took all these Groms who were amazing on a skateboard. You put them in a kayak and they were shitting bricks. Like you're taking them out of a fish out of water.
Yeah.
And it was good to get those reactions. Someone is so confident on this mode of transport, but you put them in this. And they shit a brick.
And some of these Groms went on to do amazing things, right?
Lucien Clark, I mean, he's, you know, big time. Ross McGowan became one of the better, you know, skaters out there. Ben Kilner went on to, I think, three different Olympics. Got to the final in Vancouver in halfpipe. Petty Graham's crushing it. Murray Buchan did the Olympics. So, yeah, we've had Olympic athletes. We've had, you know, some of Chris Vile, some of the best street skaters out there. Sam Bruce, one of the top female skaters to come out of this country. So, yeah.
And speaking of...
Ben Ramers. Pour a little bit out for Ben.
Yeah. Maybe. Shout out to all of these athletes and Kylie Minogue and Davina McCall. I hope you get to watch this. So, obviously, you had on this show a huge bus. And you drove that bus. And you drove it all the way across America. And then there was also a rumor that popped up in our research that something happened to that bus.
Oh, God. We bought a 76 Bluebird International school bus in Denver for $1,500. There's a reason why it was $1,500. We went through three starter motors. No. Three engines. Three full engine rebuilds. 11 batteries. A couple alternators. Yeah. I mean, it never ran so good until when we decided to sell it, but it didn't have a bathroom, which was really hard for snowboarding because, you know, you have to go out of the bus and piss.
Yeah.
So you would, you know, you'd be in the bus and you would just fill up a cup. And then the next morning you'd pull your piss out of the cup frozen and throw it out. It was cold. But yeah, it was a fun bus, and we sold a bit of the advertising on there, and you know, we had big flames coming off the hood in the back because it says school bus, so we painted in the S and we made the H into an O, so it was COOOL, cool bus. And also with buses in America, they have, whenever you open the door, a stop sign comes out, and it's a legit stop sign, so all traffic
would
stop. And we never had it taken off. So we're just stopping traffic all the time. And I was like, we got to get that removed.
The cool bus just cruising through all these amazing mountain spots sounds like such an amazing adventure. And that adventure never stopped. And I know that people, when they speak of you, say, yeah, you drove, you were a mechanic, you were filming, you were presenting, you were trying tricks. But also the whole time you brought barbecue materials.
Well, I always think the best way to feed somebody is not give them fast food because they're going to crash and burn. You know, yeah. You got to feed them good food. So I always, like on the Groms tours, I would put a Weber kettle in the bathroom. Because one, I didn't want anybody doing a number two in there because I don't want to drop that tank.
Yeah.
You know, you can do pisses in there, but no one doing number twos. So I wanted to block it all off so they couldn't. And then I'd roll out the Weber and cook for people. And just put good food in everybody. And there's a really cool scene in Rad, the Groms Tour America. And there was a hotel in Oregon where the pool was so good. They drained it. And this guy took over this hotel and he realized all these skaters were going in there. He's like, well, I'm going to make it so you have to stay in my hotel if you want to skate the pool. So we're like, we're going to come, we're going to book out tons of your rooms. And we're going to film here. And the guy was like, great. So he brought out bubble machines. I put the grill out. I was making breakfast burritos. And we had Ben Grove come over, 18-year-old Ben Grove, skating with all the Groms. Because I flew him in. And we just had a pool sesh. And it was sick. And a lot of the skaters were street skaters, like Lucy and Clark. So this is like their first time hitting proper tranny. You know, hard trannies because it's pool. Skate, you know, it was a swimming pool. Drained. So those are some of my favorite
skate.
Oh, I love those memories and gnarly footage.
Yeah.
To boot. Mm.
And why, how come even then? So obviously you were barbecuing, you were making this like tasty food there. Did you ever just want to make that a big part of the show? Did you ever think when you were barbecuing, like, I really love this. I love feeding these people.
Yeah. And I asked the producer, John Leach, I really want to put barbecue in here. And he's like, Christian, it's a skateboarding show. Well, why would you want to include it's know what the show is. Don't try to put in your love of barbecue into the show. And I was like, all right. And I snuck it in here and there, but you know, I couldn't do like anything else. I was just trying to expand the show again. So it was when Rad finished and my time at Vans finished that I went back into radio and then I was DJing a lot. And that's when I had the epiphany to pursue barbecue and make it a career.
That, my friends, is the perfect place to wrap up Christian's career in action sports. But stay tuned for more because in the next episode, Christian will be telling us all about his career in music and catering, or as he likes to say, catertainment. And just how that legend that is DJ Barbecue was born. Here's a little teaser of what's to come.
Quickest way to someone's heart is their stomach in their ears. David Loftus, who's the most published food photographer in the world, he was about to shoot my book. He's like, DJ Barbecue, come here. DJ Barbecue, Pippa Middleton, DJ Barbecue. And I go, hi, Pips. And I spun around and go, can you unzip me? I really have to wee.
Scenes is brought to you by Truant London. I am your host, Kosti Kontaravdis. My co-host on this episode was Max Ryby-Williams. The producers on this show are Lucy Austin and Max Ryby-Williams. Research by Ruby Carter. Our technical director is Tom Kemp. Edit and sound design by me, Kosti Kontaravdis, with music by Otis McDonald. Of course, an extra special thanks goes to our guest, Christian Stevenson. Until next time, scenes.